The Media Room of Zeppelin University presents Speech of Professor Steve Fuller of the University of Warwick on What does it mean to live in a time of customized knowledge production? A social epistemology for today. Presented at Zeppelin University on the 29th of March 2016.
Okay, well, first of all, let me thank Lucas for inviting me to give this talk, and also, it's a pretty good crowd actually, considering it's an evening, and I'm sure some of you might have better things to do. But what I want to do here is basically to introduce this area of research that, at least I've received the first chair in, which is called social epistemology. And to kind of bring it up to date in terms of how it applies to issues that are going on today. And as was rightly introduced, this is not just an issue about academics and, you know, scientists and so forth, but also about the way in which people in general are changing in terms of their relationship to knowledge. And so I'm going to start with some relatively elementary things from a philosophical standpoint. First of all, I think one of the things that's very interesting about the term social epistemology is that it's got the social in it, right? In other words, there's a kind of conception of epistemology that you know that already exists within philosophy that isn't social, right? And so when one thinks about somebody like Descartes, for example, right, where knowledge is something between the individual knower and the world. Okay, there isn't any kind of society that's involved. In fact, if you go back to the kinds of arguments that Descartes was part of in the 17th century and the early modern period of philosophy, one of the things that you see is that the social is often seen as something that gets in the way of having knowledge, right? Where the social is identified with, let's say, religious authority, right? Which in some sense is blocking your access to knowledge of the world. And knowledge of the world has to do with you as an individual reasoning things for yourself, you know, or observing things for yourself. And so, not surprisingly, Descartes is seen as a very major figure in what was the scientific revolution of the 17th century. And the key thing about that from the standpoint of epistemology is that it started to distrust authority, and authority being kind of the major form in which the social would appear. Okay? And so the idea, and so in a sense, epistemology kind of begins in a kind of with an anti-social prejudice of sorts. However, this is obviously a simplification, because one of the things that does happen in the 17th century, around the same time of Descartes, or maybe the generation after Descartes, is that you get something like the Royal Society, right? The Royal Society of London is the first scientific society, and this is established in the 1660s, about 30 years after Descartes is writing. And this becomes kind of, in a way, the new social. So instead of having the social being based on religious authority of priests and things like this, you get a new sense of social, which has to do with a group, a sort of self-selecting, self-organizing group of inquirers who trust each other's judgments about what they've seen and what they've reasoned about. And this idea, in a way, was very much inspired by a contemporary of Descartes, Francis Bacon, who's often seen, along with Descartes, as the founders of the scientific method. And the thing that Bacon pointed to, which was very important for the establishment of the Royal Society and sort of the sense in which knowledge became socialized again, was that whatever observations, whatever forms of reasoning that you're engaged in, it should be possible that other people can check it, right? Other people can test it. In other words, we don't just have to believe you on faith, right? So the point is that we can check it, we can test it. And this idea becomes a very important kind of idea, but it has problems, and it's not perfect, because one of the things that I think was characteristic of the way in which Francis Bacon, and this is true too of Descartes and all these people who started the scientific revolution, is the idea that actually people just using their minds in some way, or using their senses in some way, can actually know the world either individually or collectively. That it isn't, you know, in a sense, what one is really trying to do is remove the barriers to trying to understand the world. But otherwise, our senses, our knowledge, our reasoning is perfectly fine. But we just have to remove barriers in the way. Now, this becomes an interesting proposition, and it's one that gets pursued quite a lot in the Enlightenment, right? So the Enlightenment, in a sense, is a kind of more generalized movement, right? In a way, it takes sort of these insights of Descartes and Bacon and says, basically, not only do we need to overthrow the forms of religious authority that, let's say, was preventing science from developing, but we can overthrow kind of religious authority more generally, right? And we can have, as it were, people constitute themselves not only as scientific societies like the Royal Society of London, but can constitute themselves as republics, as states, right, in the modern sense, right? And so we move into this idea of the possibility of democracy as a form, as a rational form of government. Because, of course, democracy has been well known, you know, for the 2,000 years prior to the Enlightenment. But in most cases, democracy was regarded as an irrational form of rule. But what you start to get in the Enlightenment is the possibility that actually, if you take a majority of people, you know, exercising their reason, exercising their senses, understood as being healthy, adequate, and so forth, you can actually get an optimal society. This idea actually gets put on the table. Not everybody believes it. People have issues with it, but it's there as a positive idea of democracy for the first time. Again, democracy's always existed, but this is the first time it's ever been thought of as positive. Okay? And of course, there had been republics, you know, in the ancient world. But republics, in a way, are very much like scientific societies, okay? In the sense that republics tended to be small and relatively elite, right? So the key thing about republics was always the citizenship requirement, right? How do you get into this place? And of course, you know, if you look at the Athenian Republic or the Roman Republic, issues of birth mattered a lot. Whether you had a proprietary stake in the society mattered a lot. And that necessarily kept the society small in terms of citizens, and those were the people who were regarded as equals, and it was among them that there was a kind of democracy. But of course, if you think about Athens, right? Athens was a city in its heyday in the 4th century BC, with maybe 250,000 people, only 25,000 of whom were citizens. Okay, and this was common in what were called republics. Republics were not necessarily enfranchising everyone as citizens. But what you start to get in the Enlightenment is the idea that all people living in a society, regardless of what their proprietary stakes are, might actually be eligible for citizenship at some point. So in other words, you start to get a fully democratized notion of republics. This takes a long time, actually, to get realized fully, of course. And even though this idea is floated in the Enlightenment, it really takes, to be honest with you, until, what, the first half of the 20th century before this is really fully realized. And then through various stages. And so, of course, an important moment in the 1920s, for example, is women getting the right to vote, generally speaking, okay? And this is only in the 1920s, and it's 150 years after these ideas had already been floated for the first time. But the key thing in these ideas of democracy that were being put forth in the Enlightenment was the idea that you can trust the judgment of people, that people were sufficiently sane and rational with regard to their intellects and their senses, and if there weren't barriers in their way, their judgment can be trusted. Okay? So this is an epistemological point. It's a kind of social epistemological point. This idea, of course, has lots of ramifications. So one of the things that you see both in Kant and in someone who's normally seen as an antagonist to Kant, Jeremy Bentham. So in modern ethics, for example, we've got these two views. Kant's view, right, is a view about deontology, as it's called, which is the idea that you have a duty-based form of ethics, and the duty is based on a kind of categorical imperative, a kind of universalism, right? Namely, you sort of imagine yourself in the position of anyone, and would anyone understood as a rational agent decide to do what you're thinking about doing? So again, you're sort of imagining everyone as being as rational as you. That's one way to go. Now with Bentham, of course, we have another way to go, and that's utilitarianism, where you literally count people because you treat each one equally as an individual, and so it matters to count them. Right? In other words, the thing about utilitarianism that I think people often underestimate is the degree to which it treats each individual equally. Okay? And it treats each individual's judgment equally. And of course, voting systems are very much based on this kind of idea. And so there's a kind of egalitarianism, right, that then leads to the need for a kind of social epistemology. Now, one of the things that this general view of things presupposes, okay, is that human beings are comparable, right? Each individual is equal to each individual. This is true of Kant, and this is true of Bentham. This is why it's easy for Kant to imagine what any rational person would think. Because in a sense, all rational people are kind of the same in some sense, in some abstract sense, perhaps. Similarly, with Jeremy Bentham, there's a sense in which you can treat each individual equally because in some sense, they are the same. Now, if we stick with Bentham for a moment, it's pretty obvious why they're the same. Because Bentham believes we are, roughly speaking, similar animals. Okay? Homo sapiens. We are individuals with the same kinds of capacities that we're born with, and if we're allowed to develop them, they will be within a certain kind of range, and those are the kinds of beings that we are. So there is that fundamental ontological equality of human beings. Now, with Kant, I think, what he's going after is something about an equality of the spirit, right? In some sense, and again, going back to a kind of Christian notion that's always in the back of his mind, is the idea we're all created in the image and likeness of God, and so we're all equally mindful creatures, right? That's the thing that matters for him. But the point that I want to stress, it doesn't matter whether it comes from the spirit or from the body, right? But it's an equality issue, right? In other words, there's some sense in which all human beings are at some fundamental level equal, and that's why you can take all of their judgments equally seriously. Okay? This is a very important point. It's very much part of kind of modern democratic sensibility. And it's very much rooted in something about how you explain the nature of being human. Right? What is it that all human beings have in common? This becomes a very important point. Now, I'm laying all this stuff out to you because I think maybe you know this already or maybe not, but I do think this has been very much, very important in terms of the way in which a kind of default position, you might say, with regard to how we think about issues of knowledge in terms of human beings. But what I want to point to you now is that we're living in a period where this kind of ontological equality of humans, however it is established, is being seriously challenged. Okay? And in a way more so than ever before, because of course, there have been challenges to this kind of lineage that I've been giving you. Of course, I mean, we have issues like racism, for example, right? That human beings aren't born equal. They are different, right? And often this was associated with a certain idea that there are actually multiple species of hominids, as it were, and that we're not all really of the same species, but we've sort of branched out in different ways, and it's only through some kind of sentimental sympathy that we think that all of these hominids are in fact part of the same species and are entitled to the same level of equality. Right? This kind of view was actually very much around in the Enlightenment, and it played a very, and of course in the 19th century, it became very much backed up by science, and also in the early 20th century, and it often, in terms of what the political and moral consequences of this view were, they were actually all over the map, okay? So, for example, I mean, I think it's easy from the standpoint of today to think about what I'm talking about, right, in terms of the legacy of Nazism and this kind of stuff, where, in a sense, the racism leads to a kind of domination, if not extermination, of weaker races and things of that kind. Of course, that's the way we understand it today. But if you go back to the 18th century, where they also had their fair share of racists, racism was used actually to justify a non-interference policy with regard to, let's say, Africans. Okay? In other words, Europeans should not be going over to these places and turning and bringing these people over to Europe and the New World as slaves, because they're not going to function well there. They're not meant for that kind of life. You should just leave them alone in Africa and not have these kind of universalist illusions that somehow, you know, the Europeans can somehow domesticate all of these people. No, these people are essentially members of different species and should be left alone. David Hume is very good on this point. Okay? David Hume is very good on this point. So the point is, this is an argument against slavery based on racism. Okay? So keep in mind, racism, from a political and ethical standpoint, has a lot of different manifestations historically. Right? And when you start to, you see, one of the things that I think you need to keep in mind when you think about racism, and I'm not going to spend the whole talk talking about racism, but I think it's worth keeping in mind, that racism as a concept, the idea, the opposition to equality of people, originated in a time where the difference between biological inheritance and cultural inheritance was not very clear. So, for example, if you want to look to, you know, those of you out here who are cultural relativists, who believe that every culture should live in its own way and the West should stop meddling in what they're doing, and you know, this kind of anti-imperialist stuff that's very popular, right? If you want to find the precedent for those arguments, you go to guys like David Hume. You go to those 18th century racists. That's who you'd go to. That's who you're going to find people who sound like you. Right? These people didn't draw any sharp distinction between the biological and the cultural. And so they saw the cultural as a reflection of an inherent difference. And indeed, this connection between the biological and the cultural remains very robust in the 19th century. Okay? And of course, then it starts to play in with all of the other political developments that are taking place, like imperialism and nationalism and things of that kind. So I think that, you know, so this idea of there being multiple species, okay, is one that has a kind of a resonance across a broad range of political ideologies. And I want to refer to you one book before, because I'm going to move from this topic, but there's one book that's come out, in the last few months, actually. You may not know about it, but it's worth looking up if you're interested in this particular aspect of things. Because I think we are now entering into a period where we're going to start to rethink these issues of whether all human beings are the same or equal or whatever. I think it's going to come from a different direction than this came from, but nevertheless, if you're interested in what I've been talking about right now, I recommend a book called Political Biology. And the author is Maurizio, there it is, Meloni, okay? And this book actually gives you this kind of history that we're talking about here and tries to bring the issue up to date. Now, what does it mean to bring the issue up to date here? Well, historically, concepts of racism have been historically, they've been historically based, these historical concepts of racism, right? They have to do with knowing something about where the people came from, what kind of, you know, where was the origin, right? How did they develop? Right, the degree to which they have been relatively isolated from other cultures and other peoples, and that then explains why they've developed in the very specific way they have. Right, so we talk a lot about adaptation to the environment and this somehow being genetically transmitted over time. Right, this is very much part of what you would get from the kind of racist line in the 18th century and also in the early anthropology period, okay, in the 19th century. But what I want to talk about now is something a bit different, because it doesn't have to do with where you're coming from, but it has to do with where you're going, okay? And that is the possibility that we may be multiplying species by direct choice, okay? And here, I want to talk about issues relating to what's called transhumanism. Okay, how many of you are familiar with this term, transhumanism? Good, that's a few. That's better than usual. So transhumanism is an ideology. To give you a sense of what it is in terms of where it comes from. This is a term that was coined in the 1950s by evolutionary biologist Julian Huxley, who some of you may know in English. He is the person who put together the evolutionary synthesis as we know it today. In other words, this kind of view of taking Darwin's natural selection concept, which was largely related to natural history, the kind of and the actual historical development of the Earth, with the kind of lab-based genetics and eventually molecular biology, which has been the leading edge of biological research since the end of World War II. He put these things together into a common theory called what's known as the evolutionary synthesis. There were several people who did this, but he was the one who did this in a big way in the United Kingdom in the 1940s. Now, in the 1950s, right when we're getting at the in the very beginning of the molecular revolution in biology, with the discovery of the function of DNA, Huxley wrote an essay where he talked about a transhuman future. And this was the idea that he was basically trying to explain, from this kind of evolutionary standpoint, how are humans to be distinguished from other animals? Because as you know, from Darwin's standpoint, there isn't really a difference, right? In a sense that, yes, we are different in terms of where we are in the history of evolution. We are different with regard to how our genes are configured. But we're basically made of the same basic stuff, and the differences amongst the species are fairly marginal from a genetic standpoint. And moreover, all the species in a very general kind of way tend to behave the same way in that they come into existence and they eventually go out of existence, right? So in other words, extinction's on the cards for everyone, for everything. And it maybe doesn't seem so obvious to us because we're just the latest ones. Okay? But same thing's going to happen to us. At least this was very much Darwin's perspective on the matter. I think this made a big difference with regard to Darwin's relatively pessimistic view with regard to the human condition. Darwin did not believe in progress. Darwin, in fact, when he in his book The Descent of Man, made a very big point of saying that the causes of war and strife and conflict and violence in the human condition has to do with the fact that we have these overextended cerebral cortices, which enable us to have all kinds of crazy ideas, which we then take to be real, and we start dying for them. Now, if our brains were not so overdeveloped with these ideas, right, we would live a much easier life, a much better adapted life to the environment, and we wouldn't be causing so many problems. And so that was one reason. So Darwin was anti-imperialist, actually. Even though his ideas were used by imperialists, he himself was anti-imperialist. And he was even very reluctant to get to support vivisection, right? The cutting up of animals for research purposes. He was a very moderate guy, okay? Julian Huxley, in a way, saw this as a kind of challenge to how to re-specify what is distinctive about the human condition, right? Because if you believe Darwin is, you know, on the biological front, there really isn't anything very distinctive about the human condition, at least not anything very distinctive that's positive, right? It may be that we have, as it were, more violent and ingenious ways of destroying ourselves in the world, but the point is, there isn't anything very positive going on in Darwin's view. But Huxley makes the following argument. This is where transhumanism comes in. Namely, that even though we, just like all the other species, must obey evolution, natural selection, that is the rule, the difference is we know it, right? We know the theory of evolution. We know natural selection. And that knowledge then opens up spheres of freedom that had previously not been available to other creatures, other species. And so Huxley was arguing that this puts a kind of moral obligation on humans to take control of what is otherwise a blind process of natural selection. In other words, what humans have the capacity to do by virtue of knowing evolutionary theory is to give evolution intelligence. Right? We become the brain of evolution. Right? And that's where and the term for that was transhumanism in the 1950s. Okay? This is kind of, you know, this idea was put on the table. Not much was done with it. If you go to Google Analytics and you look at the use of words, right, when the words appear in books, transhumanism, there's a little blip on the screen for the late 1950s, early 60s. But you don't see much after that until you get into the 1990s. And of course, this idea starts to get some momentum again. And of course, it's now very much on the table in various forms. When Huxley was thinking about transhumanism, what he had in mind, and this view is still on the table, but it's only one of the transhumanisms on the table, he was thinking about it as eugenics 2.0. Okay? Now, eugenics, again, I know this scary word for people. Eugenics was a very kind of broad-based movement supported mainly by the left in the early 20th century. And it was about improving the human condition in a very systematic way, not just in terms of providing better nutrition and providing better education, but also better gene pool. Okay? And Huxley... And you may know, if you know anything, Huxley was very influential in ensuring that one of the things that he did was he prevented genetics as a science from being shut down entirely as a result of the Nuremberg trials. So he was the head of the, he was the first scientific director of UNESCO, and so his opinion was sought on, you know, as the Nuremberg trials were going on, about whether the atrocities of the Nazis meant that one should just shut down genetics altogether. And of course, he said no. And he said that what mattered was just that it had to be regulated and governed properly. And I don't know how much you know about Huxley in this respect, but Huxley was the person who was behind UNESCO's very famous and influential statement on the nature of race in 1950. UNESCO put out a very important document on the nature of race, which said that race basically was a social construction and was biologically unreliable. Right? You're familiar with this view. I think this is still very much the default view in the academy. And Huxley was responsible for that document, okay? But when Huxley proposed this, he wasn't denying that biology had a role. What he was saying was that the role that biology has is up to the societies who know about the biology, right? So in other words, part of what you're going to be using to do your social construction is the gene pool. But the point is, the gene pool itself doesn't tell you what to do, right? And traditional racism was very much about, you know, genetics say, right? These people are inferior. These people are superior. No, what Huxley was saying, what genetics say will be dependent upon what kind of society you want to construct. And then genetics can tell you something about it. But you have to make the value choices at the beginning about what sort of society you want. And then genetics can play a role in terms of giving you the kind of people you need. Okay? So when we talk about the social construction of race, that's what actually Huxley had in mind. It wasn't that, in some sense, biology is a myth or something like this, the way in which sometimes people interpret the idea of the social construction of race. No. Rather, it was a matter of choice. Okay? Now, what I want to say to you is that in the future, people are going to get more comfortable with this idea than they might have been 50, 60 years ago. And that they are going to be making choices about the kinds of beings they wish to be, or they wish their children to be, or they wish to be around. Okay? And so this is a different kind of multiplication of humanity. This is different from the classical racism, which was very much led from behind, right? Led from the past, right? These beings, you know, these different races came about because they were bred in these different environments, and they only can be what they can be because of those environments and the way they've reproduced. No, in the future, one's going to talk about inventing races and multiplying them that way. You see? Now, why might we end up this way? Well, one reason is because a lot of this stuff isn't very well regulated. Okay, and this is a very interesting feature about kind of the legacy of the fear of biologization. It's made people kind of blind to the fact that depending on what sort of society you live in, right, you may have more or less access to being able to influence what the future humanity is going to be, right? So we have this gene editing technology that's just been discovered in the past year, okay? The first thing that worried not only scientists but policymakers was the fact that China's got it, because China is an ethics-free zone, right? And anything can happen in China. And not only can anything happen in China, it can happen on a large scale, and it'll be too late before we find out about it because nobody knows Chinese. Okay? So this is an interesting point, right? So in other words, the way in which this kind of pluralization can already happen is the fact that this whole you know, advancement of biology and biotechnology isn't systematically regulated. And when I say regulated, I don't mean stopped. I mean monitored and checked and people actually knowing what other people are doing. That's what I mean by regulation. I'm quite liberal, actually, in my own dispositions about things. But I do believe that we should know what everybody is up to, especially because these things have all sorts of unintended consequences. And my view, so for example, with gene editing, you may be able to target a very specific gene that you either want to enhance or diminish, but what you don't know is what the knock-on effects are on the other genes. Right? I mean, so the point is, there are massive unintended consequences. Many of them, maybe most of them, don't matter. And we're not really going to know until it's done in a sufficiently large scale. So we actually don't know what the scope for human diversification is by the use of these technologies that are right on the horizon. Okay? And so even if we are inclined to want to give people the right, as it were, to design their offspring or to make various kinds of genetic changes in their genome or whatever, we nevertheless need to think about what the consequences are going to be even if we give people what they want. Right? How is the society going to be prepared for this? Right? And what I think one of the things that we need to be prepared for here is a greater tolerance of plurality than we've ever seen before. Okay? In other words, I mean, see, here's the little trick, right? When you look at the history of liberalism and all of this stuff from John Locke, right? You know, John Locke, the great English political theorist of the early Enlightenment, and he's all about tolerance and the liberal society, and basically you should allow people to do as much as they want, as long as they don't interfere with other people's ability to do what they want. Now, this kind of idea sounds pretty straightforward if you imagine, once again, that people are, roughly speaking, natural equals. Right? When John Locke and all of these liberals, right, and Adam Smith, you can include him in this thinking, right, one of the things that, you know, made the whole idea that we could have a self-organizing liberal society without a king watching over us, without heavy regulation from the top and all of this kind of stuff, was because at the end of the day, you trusted that everyone was a natural equal and fully functioning and sufficiently similar, even if they were different with regard to their particular interests. Nevertheless, those differences canceled out, you might say, or complemented each other, so that you could actually have a coherent society built from different people, right? Which is what the promise of liberalism is, right? Liberalism presupposes people are different. They're individually different, but they're not so different that they can't live together, right? So the differences are within a level of tolerance. And you can think about tolerance here, not just in the political sense, but in the statistical sense, right? It's tolerance. Tolerance of error, right? Different deviation only goes so far. You don't have massive deviation. And what we're talking about here, you know, what would be massive deviation? Not only that people have radically different interests, whereby one group of people cannot actually do what they consider essentially their thing without obliterating somebody else. It's not just that. But if we're talking about different kinds of resource constraint requirements, right? Certain kinds of individuals may, in fact, require more resources just to survive than others. Okay? I mean, I think one of the reasons why, for example, that there's always, you know, if you think about the welfare state has always been very much preoccupied with the idea that nobody should just be given benefits, but there should always be some kind of work thing going on, and people should somehow be brought into work, right? Because that, in a way, then reduces the differentials in resource consumption, right? Because people are contributing to something as well as taking out, and they're not just consuming. These problems can become much greater in the kind of world we're coming to, okay? Especially because a lot of the consequences of all of this experimentation that we're about to undergo is not necessarily, like I say, it's going to be unintended, and unintended sometimes means not quite what you wanted, right? In other words, you know, even if you're trying to make your kid the smartest kid in the world or have a very special quality, you may end up creating someone who is dysfunctional in some way. Now, what do we do about that? What do we do about that? I think that that we have to start thinking about that, and I think this is where we need to expand our notions of tolerance. Okay? Now, where are the ideas for expanding these notions of tolerance going to come from? Well, now I want to turn to a different strand of transhumanism. Okay? And this strand of transhumanism has to do more with the technological side. So you know, some of you who know about transhumanism know about perhaps Ray Kurzweil. You familiar with him, Ray Kurzweil? Some are? Good, good, okay. So Ray Kurzweil is very much about uploading of consciousness into machines and providing, you know, using the silicon base as a way of amplifying those distinctive human qualities to levels that could never be reached just in the biological organism. Okay? So we end up acquiring this kind of digital resurrection, right, which at the limit becomes the singularity, right, where we have access to all knowledge, right? And maybe this involves some kind of collective, massive collective consciousness, right? And he's been pushing this idea for 20 years now. I mean, it's getting popular now, but he's been doing it for a while. And the first book was The Age, right, of Spiritual Machines. That's where he started from, okay? Now this is an interesting aspect of transhumanism, because what it starts to reveal about our conception of the human, or at least some people's conception of the human, is that it isn't necessarily tied to the biological, right? Because Huxley, you know, he's a biologist, and there are lots of transhumanists in this vein, somehow think that if you want to improve the human condition and get to a kind of humanity 2.0, you've got to stay within the platform of Homo sapiens. Right? You're going to do something to change Homo sapiens. You're not just going to migrate to a new platform that takes you completely out of the carbon-based evolution. But this is, in fact, what Kurzweil is suggesting. Okay? And that there be some people who, at some point, transition into this. Okay? Moreover, there are people, transhumanists, in the middle of these two extremes, okay? And these are the cyborg people, right? And you know about cyborgs. So cyborgs are these hybrid creatures, right? That are, so cybernetic organism, right? That's what the term means, cybernetic organism. And a cyborg is a creature, because remember, with cybernetics, if you recall, cybernetics 101, animal, human, machine, they are all subject to the same principles, right? They can be understood in terms of the same principles as autonomous systems. So the next step, second lesson in cybernetics, is you can mix and match them, right? So in some sense, you can have animal and human together, right, in some kind of combination, or human and machine together in some kind of combination, and these would be cyborgs, okay? Now, you know, you think about cyborgs. They don't just exist in science fiction. We've got Stephen Hawking. He is a real cyborg. Okay? He's not the only real cyborg. He's probably the most famous cyborg. But to the extent that people's lives are dependent upon, you know, complex technology, prosthetics, things of that kind, to get around. They are cyborgs, technically speaking. Now, the thing about them is, of course, they are cyborgs, but they have not lost their status as human by virtue of being cyborg. It's like acquiring dual citizenship, right? They're human and they're cyborg. They're both. We have not yet entered into a regime where we require that you have to make a choice between the two. Right? It's a very important point, because we may enter into such a world. Okay? And this is where the issue of tolerance becomes important, okay? You know, so for example, let me refer you to a policy paper that came out about 18 months ago. I don't know, you may know the Brookings Institution, which is a left of center think tank in Washington, okay? They put out a policy paper, you can download it from their website, called Our Cyborg Future. Our Cyborg Future. And this was written by lawyers, okay? The situation that prompted this particular policy report was a case that was tried before the Supreme Court of the United States, which basically the Supreme Court decided, you may not know this, and it wasn't that well publicized, I believe the case was called Ryan versus California, but you can find it in their thing, whereby the Supreme Court basically said that the police had acted unlawfully in a case when they searched the smartphone of a suspect without their permission. Okay? And the reasoning that was given by the justices was that the smartphone was part of the person. Okay? That's the key point. Even though the smartphone is actually separate from the physical human, nevertheless, that was considered part of the person. So the point that the Brookings Institution was making here was that not only do we already have cyborgs in our midst, but from a legal standpoint, right, depending on the nature of the relationship between the piece of technology and the human, the technology doesn't have to be attached to the human physically, right? It just could be, as it were, a necessary part of the human's identity and existence that, from a legal standpoint, counts as part of the proper person. In that sense, it gets a status that is higher than what we would normally regard with regard to personal property, right? Because we also have that kind of notion. But here we're talking about the person themselves being violated. Okay? Now, the cyborg idea, whether we think about cyborgs in terms of prosthetics or we think about these separate items like a smartphone, right, is part of this general idea that gets talked about in the philosophy of mind as the extended mind. Okay, so in other words, I mean, and this is usually said to be a kind of thesis in psychology, but in fact, I think this can be seen as a much deeper kind of ontological thesis about what the boundaries are of humanity. Right? What is properly part of a human being? Right? Not only what constitutes a human being, but what is part of that human being? Okay? Now, the sorts of situations that the Brookings Institution is envisioning in the future is one which I have witnessed, I have to say. Now, I give a lot of talks in London, and as you know, London is a very funky, hipster kind of place, especially if you go to the east part of London. And I was on a panel last year, and you can find this on YouTube, which had six members, so a big audience, of all these hipster, funky type people who are very open to all this stuff. What? And there were six members of the audience. Six members of the panel. Three of them were non-cyborg humans, including myself. And the other three were very much cyborg humans, okay, with very sophisticated prosthetics on them in various ways. Now, the point is that at the moment, and now the thing about prosthetics, of course, is not only do they at some level restore some kind of disability, but they don't quite do it by giving you exactly what you lost, right? They give you a kind of spin on it. That's kind of how to think about prosthetics, right? They give you kind of a new way of having an arm, a new way of having a leg, which enables you not only to be able to walk or to grab, but also to do other things, perhaps, that a normal-bodied human being cannot do. Right? That's the thing about prosthetics. Prosthetics have these unintended consequences, as it were. Right? And some people manage to find some very interesting uses for these new powers that they acquire through prosthetics. Now, at the moment, you can only get these prosthetics if you are classified as disabled. Right? It is generally very difficult, if not impossible. Maybe it's possible in China, I don't know. But in Western countries, it is generally very difficult to actually say, hey, you know, I see that there's this really nifty prosthetic arm that can do all this weird shit, you know. And my arm, you know, I've had it now for whatever, 40, 50 years. And, you know, and I know what it can do and what it can't do. And I think it's, you know, it's time for an upgrade. So can you saw this off and put the other thing on? That's not allowed. Not yet, right? At the end of this panel, right, and this was done spontaneously, this was not planned, but it was incredibly telling, right? The person who had organized this event, which is, of course, was as usual with these events, very over-enthusiastic person saying, asked the audience, how many of you would like to have one of these prosthetics? And my God, it was a good 40% of the audience that they would trade in working limbs, working bits, right, to have these other things put on them. And actually, the Brookings Institution is reflecting on this, namely, that insofar as people like Stephen Hawking, for example, are presented as very positive figures, right? I mean, all of these cyborgs in our midst, right? And we think about the Paralympics, for example, right? There are all these things already where prosthetic, there is an attractiveness. And of course, you have also the whole cultural background of science fiction and so forth with cyborgs in them already, all the Star Trek episodes, right? There's a lot of attractive imagery of cyborgs, okay? And so what you end up having are people who basically would like to, you know, have these things, even though they don't, by our ordinary definitions, have any kind of disability, okay? So there's going to be a quest, what this suggests, right? And I think that this is a good point to raise, namely, the idea of normal that can serve as a baseline, right, which has been very important for our notions of tolerance and liberality and things like this, this is disappearing. There is a very strong openness to experimentation in fairly radical ways. And then the question becomes, how do you have society? Because it's one thing, right, to have all these cyborgs when they're thought of as fairly marginal cases in a society where you imagine most people aren't going to need to have all of these very sophisticated treatments and so forth, right? And we can kind of understand. And so we then have, you know, special ramps for disabled people and things of that kind. And they're seen as kind of marginal things to the normal way of doing things, and we have ways of dealing with that. But what happens if this becomes desirable state? Okay? And the Brookings Institution, what it is arguing, and I think this is a very fair point, and this is kind of part of the customization issue that I raise in the title of this talk, right, is the fact that as people see more and more different ways of being human, and they're portrayed in a positive way, not only in fiction, but also in reality, people, and also as people realize that our technology is becoming more advanced and more capable, and people will want to get more directly involved and will want to be making choices for themselves, okay? And people, as a result, will be less likely to trust kind of global pronouncements about what is healthy, what is normal, right? People will want space to do whatever they do. And of course, if you think about the internet as being a primary source of information for all this stuff, and that is, you know, so well available, that this kind of future where we're going to be pluralizing forms of humanity is likely to grow, right? Not only in terms of genetic experimentation, but also in terms of technological experimentation. And then the question becomes, I think, and I've written a book called The Proactionary Imperative, because I actually support this. What I'm talking about, I actually support. But I think it really brings some very serious kinds of normative questions about how we govern a society with such pluralism, okay? Because transhumanists do have a tendency to want to basically give every different kind of creature their space, a kind of a ontological apartheid, you know? That's kind of how they think about things. So in other words, people who have like capacities ought to have the right to kind of exist in their way, and there's some space should be given for them. And we should have as much, many of those spaces as possible, and so this is where colonizing other planets might be useful, especially for beings that don't require oxygen so much. Seriously. Okay? Now, I'm kind of old-fashioned. I believe in the idea of a liberal society, that actually if we're smart enough to do this kind of nonsense that we're doing now, we should be smart enough to be able to reconstitute liberalism and the idea of people of differences realizing, right, their mutual value in a common society. And being able to come up with notions of rights and duties that each different group or of individuals have toward one another. That's kind of what I think the normative challenge is. And this has all kinds of very interesting sorts of implications with regard to how you think about stuff like, social justice, right? If you've got a being, right, who has enormous amount of prostheses or maybe someone who's had an enormous amount of neural treatment that they can calculate things much faster than anyone else can, what happens when they go up for a job against other people who are not so enhanced? And in a sense, the people I'm most worried about are like the people in this room, the non-enhanced, okay? These are the kind of people who I think are the most endangered species in the kind of future that I'm talking about, namely humanity 1.0, the people who are not enhanced, and not only are not enhanced, don't even want to be enhanced. Right? Because if I were to take a show of hands about how many people are up for what I'm talking about, I'm sure I wouldn't get most people. Well, let me try. How many people are interested in these various transhumanist futures that they would themselves participate in, either in terms of some kind of gene editing or the acquisition of prosthetics and so forth? How many of you would be up for some version of this if it were legal? Okay, see, it's a minority. So the question then is going to be, in that future, where are the rest of you? Where have you, are the rest of you? Because you know as well as I am, as I know, that research is heading in this direction, big money is heading in this direction. There's actually quite a lot of political interest in this. Not necessarily because of the kind of very far out stuff I've been talking about, but because of more short-term issues. So for example, I started getting involved in this, actually, and the person I blame is Nico Ster, actually. It's interesting, since he's here. Right, so Nico Ster headed a European Union Framework 6 project that was looking at the social and political implications of what were called converging technologies. Okay, nano, bio, info, cogno, neuro, all these different sciences and technology, somehow taking their developments and focusing them toward enhancing the human condition. In other words, rather than just treating them as independent sciences doing their own thing, what you try to do is you try to organize the research agenda so they all focus on enhancing humans. Now, this is a view that was put forward initially in the early 2000s, both by the US National Science Foundation and then later by the European Union. And if you look at what the issues were that they were concerned with, because the National Science Foundation in the United States basically saw this general horizon of research as the future of basic research. So that was a very strong claim. But why? Well, because there are going to be many of the challenges that we face at the moment from the standpoint of welfare has to do with the unenhanced nature of humans. Okay? So in other words, we live in a society where people are living longer, but they're still retiring at the same age as they did in 1890. Okay? 65. Okay? Moreover, when they retire, they're not necessarily in such great health, and their health often deteriorates. And that's a big strain on the medical system. Okay? Moreover, these people do not have as many children as previous generations did. So the relatively fewer people who are entering into the labor market are now being responsible for paying an enormous pension load on people who just end up deteriorating over time and become a strain to the health system. This is a geriatric nightmare, okay? Old people are gonna strangle the young. This is what it looks like from a welfare state standpoint. So how are you gonna change this? Well, first of all, you get people in a healthier state to be able to, so you can raise the retirement age a good 10, 20 years, so they can work longer, okay? And so from this standpoint, then you want enhanced humans. You want enhanced humans. You don't want humans who deteriorate so easily, especially if they're going to live longer. Because in a sense, our medical successes in the 20th century, which has raised the average age, you know, of the average life expectancy from 60 to close to 90 in some cases, right, is only a job half done. Right? People are living longer, but they're not necessarily living healthier. And how are we going to deal with that? We need to deal with that at the source. And this is what all this enhancement stuff ultimately is about. Okay? So that people, you don't get, you know, if you put it crudely, you don't want everyone pulling a pension. You don't want so many people pulling pensions. You want to reduce that. Okay? Now, this might mean that you end up working forever with your extended life. That's another matter. Of course, one can talk about that kind of issue. But nevertheless, I'm just giving you a sense of what the kind of practical political motivation has been on the side of policymakers to explore these rather radical options. So even if we're not talking about human beings becoming immortal, but we're just talking about their productivity increasing by another 10 years, that would actually deal with a lot of the issues of the welfare state, okay? And it would keep society together, because as you know, at the moment, this is an enormous challenge to the welfare state and is causing a general kind of legitimation crisis, which is causing society to sort of fracture in many different directions as people try to escape the consequences of it. Okay? So from the standpoint of keeping our society together, there might be something here. Okay? But the problem is then, what are these other things that you're opening yourself up to, which is what I've been talking about here, namely the possibility that humanity 2.0 may represent a wide range of beings, all of whom have some kind of root in the Homo sapiens, humanity 1.0, but have diverged in various ways, very often by design, but maybe often unintentionally, and then nevertheless, they are part, at least I would want to maintain still, of a common society. And the question is, how do you govern that common society, and how do you get policymakers to take this possibility seriously? Okay? So I think I'll stop here, because I've been going on, I think, for about an hour, and I will take some questions, and I want to thank you for being so polite and listening.